So session 10. So it's 33 sessions. So I think last time we ended up with Joseph getting to Egypt. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
So remember his brothers threw him in the cistern. Then he took him out of the cistern. Then he sold him for 20 pieces of silver. Mm-hmm. And he gets taken to Egypt. And he goes to Potiphar, who's the Pharaoh's, he's the head of the Pharaoh's home guard or secret service or whatever they called it. He's the commander of it. So he buys Joseph as a slave. And because he's a smart kid and the Lord is with him, everything he does turns out to be good. The house prospers, everything's organized. So he makes him like the head slave. Kind of runs the house. And then, of course, his wife, Mrs. Potiphar, we didn't know what her name is.
I was going to say, what's her name?
I always call her Mrs. Potiphar, like Mrs. Noah. So Mrs. Potiphar, you know, tries to seduce him and tries to get him into her room and then falsely accuses him of attempting to rape her. And so he's put in prison. And there's a lot of messianic prefigurements with that, as we went over. And then we have to keep in mind, too, that prisons in those days were not like prisons of now. I mean, he was probably in some hole, some disgusting building or some dungeon. And that's where we're going to pick it up today, because when he gets to the prison, the guy who's the warden immediately befriends him and says, hey, this kid's really smart. And he seems, everything he does seems to go right. So he puts Joseph in charge of the prison. So he's in charge of taking care of the other inmates. So we're going to go to Genesis 40. And he's going to meet two people in the prison that ultimately are going to get him into Pharaoh's court. And ultimately are going to get the people from Canaan into the land. So that Jacob's whole family is going to end up not only in Egypt, but in the best part of Egypt, Goshen. Favorites of the Pharaoh loves them. And we're going to see when Jacob dies, he has like a military honor guard take him back to Canaan to bury him at the Tomb of the Patriarchs. So this big family, depending who you read, some people say 66 people went to Egypt. Some translations say 72 people went to Egypt. Somebody else counted and said, no, there's actually 77. I don't know. But 70-ish people went into Egypt. They were basically all Jacob's family. Because by this time, of course, most of the boys are married. And they have children. And so there's 70-ish people in the family. Now, Joseph is Rachel's son. And Jacob liked him the best. And the other one of Rachel's sons is Benjamin, who's the baby. And Rachel dies right after she has him. Must have called him son of my sorrow, but Jacob intervenes. So Joseph is gone by then. So he doesn't know Benjamin. Or he's just been born. I can't remember now. But anyway, he knows there is a
baby. He didn't know his mom died.
He doesn't know him.
He probably didn't know
him. Or he probably didn't know his mother died. So, now in the prison, here's what happens. Let's go to Genesis 40. And remember, Joseph had the dreams. The sheaves of grain bowing down to his sheaf. The sun and the moon and the stars going around and bowing down to him. And this is what got the brothers mad. So they didn't even talk to him. And Mr. Judah, who gets to be ancestor of the Messiah, is like this horrible guy who says, well, let's kill him. And, you know, of course, Jesus is from his tribe. Remember, these are the tribes of Israel. So we got 12 boys and a girl. The girl doesn't count. I just like to see the look on your face right there where I say that. But you know what I mean. She's not allowed to be a tribe. She marries some Irish guy and no, no. And moves to Chicago. Yeah, because then, you know, her brother Reuben shows her how to set up delis. Yeah, so I think it was the Lower East Side of Manhattan. You have to understand, though, the original Hebrew to get that out of the...
Get that out of the script.
Yes. I think Aquinas wrote a commentary on it. But anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So somebody start reading at the beginning of verse 40.
Chapter 40.
Oh,
okay. The beginning. The dreams interpreted. Sometime yeah. afterward, the royal cupbearer and baker gave offense to their lord, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two courtiers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the chief steward, the same jail where Joseph was confined. The chief steward assigned Joseph to them, and he became their attendant. After they had been in custody for some time, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the jail, both had dreams on the same night, each dream with its own meaning. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he noticed that they looked disturbed. So he asked Pharaoh's courtiers, who were with him in custody in his master's house, "Why do you look so sad today?" They answered him, "We have had dreams, but there is no one to interpret them for us." Joseph said to them, "Surely interpretation comes from God. Please tell the dreams to me." Then the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. "In my dream," he said, "I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. It had barely budded when its blossoms came out, and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes, pressed them out into this cup, and put it in Pharaoh's hand." Joseph said to him, "This is what it means. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your post. You will be handing Pharaoh his cup as you formerly used to do when you were his cupbearer. So if you will still remember when all is well with you that I was here with you, please do me the favor of mentioning me to Pharaoh, to me, to get me out of this place. The truth is that I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and here I have not done anything for which I should have been put into a dungeon."
Okay, pause there for a second. Mm-hmm. So this was the Pharaoh's cupbearer. Cupbearer was very important. Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king of Persia. If you read the book of Nehemiah, it starts out with Nehemiah being sad. He's the cupbearer. They took care of the Pharaoh's food. They tasted the food, make sure it wasn't poisoned. They drank his wine to make sure nobody poisoned the wine. I always wondered, like, if it was a long-acting poison, how would you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if it was cyanide, they would drink it and fall down. But,
right.
You know, if it was arsenic, it would take a while. But anyway.
How long does it take?
Well, arsenic could take months and months.
Oh.
Yeah. Depending how much you get. But, in other words, they protected the king, Pharaoh, from eating poisonous food. So he has this dream, and Joseph has this gift of interpreting dreams. You know, he's like Daniel. He can interpret dreams. So he says, "Oh, Pharaoh's going to rehire you, and everything's going to be back the way it was, and you're going to go back to the court with Pharaoh." And so Joseph's like, "Hey, when you get there, remember me. Remember that I told you this, because I got to get out of this place. Because I'm here, I'm innocent, I'm in this prison, I didn't do anything, I'm a Hebrew, I don't even belong here. So when you remember me to Pharaoh." Okay, go ahead from there.
When the chief baker saw that Joseph had given this favorable interpretation, he said to him, "I too had a dream, and in it I had three wicker baskets on my head. In the top one were all kinds of bakery products for Pharaoh, but the birds were pecking at them out of the basket on my head." Joseph said to him, "Reply, this is what it means. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and have you impaled on a stake, and the birds will be pecking the flesh from your body. And in fact, on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, when he gave a banquet to all his staff with his courtiers around him, he lifted up the heads of the chief cupbearer and chief baker. He restored the chief cupbearer to his office so that he again handed the cup to Pharaoh. But the chief baker he impaled, just as Joseph had told them in his interpretation. Yet the chief cupbearer gave no thought to Joseph. He had forgotten him.
Yeah. So I got bad news about your dream, dude. So both things come true. And then sadly, this last verse is so sad, yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. He's going to remember him later, though. But didn't do what Joseph had asked him. So the butler and the baker. So he interprets the dreams. The butler guy, the cupbearer, doesn't remember him. So he's stuck there for two more years. Living in this hole for 2 years. He wasn't like in solitary confinement or anything. It sounded like he could interact with people. But still, you wouldn't want to be in there. Now, he was alienated by his brother because of the two dreams. That he kind of interpreted. He knew they were going to bow down to him, which they're going to next lesson. So now, Pharaoh starts to dream. And this is where it gets really cool. Now start reading in chapter 41.
Okay, Pharaoh's dream. After a lapse of 2 years, Pharaoh had a dream. He saw himself standing by the Nile. When up out of the Nile came seven cows, handsome and fat. They grazed in the reed grass. Behind them, seven other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up and out of the Nile. And standing on the bank of the Nile beside the others, the ugly, gaunt cows ate up the seven handsome, fat cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. He fell asleep and again and had another dream. He saw 7 ears of grain, fat and healthy, growing on a single stalk. Behind them sprouted 7 ears of grain, thin and blasted by the east wind. And the seven thin ears swallowed up the seven fat, healthy ears. Then Pharaoh woke up to find it was only a dream. Next morning, his spirit was agitated. So he summoned all the magicians and sages of Egypt and recounted his dreams to them. But no one could interpret his dreams for him.
Okay, pause there. So you get the dream. Seven fat cows, seven gaunt cows. The gaunt, skinny, ugly cows eat the fat cows. Big, luxurious grain. Stimpy little grain that's all sparse and sickening eats the good grain. So he wakes up and says, what does this mean? Calls in the magicians, just like Nebuchadnezzar did. Tell me what my dream means. And of course, the magicians, the astrologers, all the like wise men of the court don't usually know what it means. Which is what gets the kings mad. But let's go down to verse 12. Now the butler, the cupbearer who he restored, pipes up when he hears all this stuff about the dream. So somebody start reading in 12.
There with us was a Hebrew youth, a slave of the chief steward. And when he told him our dreams, he interpreted them for us and explained for each of us the meaning of his dreams. And it turned out, just as he had told us, I was restored to my post, but the other man was impaled.
So now he remembers Joseph. He says, oh, 2 years ago, I was in prison with this young Hebrew guy, and he interpreted my dream and that other poor guy's dream. Remember that guy you... So maybe he can help you out. You know, these modern, just like Nebuchadnezzar, I mean, these kings are very troubled by these dreams. Because, of course, they're always worried about their powers. They're always worried about, are their gods trying, to tell them something? You know, is this a, an omen of something that's going to happen? So...
Yeah.
Now 14. Yeah.
Pharaoh therefore had Joseph summoned and then hurriedly brought him from the dungeon. After he shaved and changed his clothes, he came into Pharaoh's presence. Pharaoh then said to him, I have certain dreams that no one can interpret, but I hear it said of you that the moment you are told a dream, you can interpret it. It is not I, Joseph replied to Pharaoh, but God who will give Pharaoh the right answer.
So the magicians, the wise men can't interpret it. He calls for Joseph. Now notice it says Joseph has to like shave and clean himself up. Imagine how disgusting he is. He can't go like waltzing into Pharaoh's office, coming out of a smelly dungeon. And he acknowledges, I remember when he's confronted by Mrs. Potiphar, he says, how can I do such a thing, you know, against my God? You know, he's a moral young man who says, how can I do such a thing? Here he says, hey, it's not me that interprets the dreams, it's God gives the interpretation. So he's a faithful guy who gives God the credit for the gift that he has. You know, and everything we have is a gift from him. So, you know, in your humanity, you say, oh, well, you know, I did all that stuff. But if you said, well, you know, with the help of the Lord, I did all that stuff, or the Lord gave me the ability to do that stuff, so that you don't walk around going, hey, I can interpret dreams. Pharaoh, this was no sweat, let me tell you. And put the spotlight on you. So he acknowledges that this is a gift from God, which is pretty amazing for a young guy. So then Pharaoh tells him the dream. So let's go down to verse 25.
Joseph said to Pharaoh, both of Pharaoh's dreams have the same meaning. God has thus foretold to Pharaoh that what he is about to do. The seven healthy cows are 7 years, and the seven healthy ears are 7 years, the same in each dream. So also the seven thin, ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years, as are seven thin, wind-blasted ears. They are 7 years of famine. It is just as I told Pharaoh. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. 7 years of great abundance are now coming throughout the land of Egypt, but these will be followed by 7 years of famine, when all the abundance in the land of Egypt will be forgotten. When the famine has ravaged the land, no trace of the abundance will be found in the land because of the famine that follows it. So utterly severe will the famine be.
Some pause there. So the interpretation is 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. And the famine is going to be so bad that you're going to forget about the plenty. You know, again, when there's always food, like we can't imagine a famine,
right?
I mean, how can we imagine? You know, you go to Giant Eagle or you go to wherever, and you see like all that stuff, and you say, oh, you know, here's the cucumbers, and here's the tomatoes, and here's the apples, and here's the little steaks, and here's the chicken, and here's the rice, and here's the... I mean, if you went in there and there was, like, nothing there, what do you mean there's nothing here? I don't have anything left at home. That's famine. I mean, I think even during our depression of the 30s, you know, there was a Dust Bowl in the West, but, I mean, there wasn't famine. There was food. I mean, this is going to be a famine. It's not only going to just involve Egypt. It's also going to involve the land of Canaan, which is going to be the event that's going to lead the family to come to Egypt, because we're going to see here how Joseph is going to solve the problem. So it's the two dreams are actually one dream, same idea. 7 years are going to be great. You can have all the donuts and burgers and all the Chipotle you want, but then for 7 years. After that, no burgers, no Chipotle,
no donuts. That's a long time.
Yes.
That's a very long time.
And remember, this is North Africa. You know, there's only life in Egypt because of the Nile. If the Nile wasn't there, you know, Egypt would be just desert. Look at the difference between Egypt and Libya and Algeria and those other desert North African countries. That's why they worship the Nile. Because the Nile actually gave them life. You had this huge river, so along the banks, I don't know how far in it went, but you had fertile land where you could grow things. So the famine's going to involve not just Egypt, but actually the whole Middle East. So we don't know, some kind of, maybe it was global warming, some kind of event triggers the famine. So now Joseph comes up with a solution. How cool is this? Go ahead, keep reading.
That Pharaoh had the same dream twice means that the matter has been reaffirmed by God and that God will soon bring it about. Okay.
You dreamed it twice, so there's no question this is going to happen. It's all one dream, but you dreamed it twice. And this kind of is a take back to, in Hebrew, when you repeat something, that means it's very important. That's why Jesus says, Martha, Martha. That means listen to what I'm going to tell you. You know, the burning bush says, Moses, Moses. And you know, when you repeat somebody's name, that means what I'm going to tell you is really, really important. When an event, when you, this is why sometimes in the scripture, the same event is told several times. Like, I hate to keep talking about Daniel, but, you know, in Daniel, at the chapter 3, when Nebuchadnezzar makes the big image that everybody has to worship, it says like 4 or 5 times, when the image comes and you hear all this music, then you have to bow down. Mm-hmm. Oh, when you hear all the music, you have to bow down. It's like, this is really important that when you hear, when you see this image, you got to bow down. And, you know, that's kind of like a demonic corruption of Psalm 150. Psalm 150, David writes, you know, with all these different instruments, you praise the Lord, and everything that has breath has to praise the Lord. But with the Hebrews in Babylon, when they hear the music, they got to bow down to the image. So with the repetition, says this is really important, so pay attention. You know, Jesus says, truly, truly. He could just say it once. He could just say, what I'm going to tell you is, but when he says, truly, truly, people go, uh-oh, he's going to tell us something really important. You go ahead.
Therefore, let Pharaoh seek out a wise and discerning man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Pharaoh should also take action to appoint overseers so as to regiment the land during the 7 years of abundance. They should husband all the food of the coming good years, collecting the grain under Pharaoh's authority to be stored in towns for food. This food will serve as a reserve for the country against the 7 years of famine that are to follow in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish in the famine.
So here's the plan. During the 7 years where there's plenty, you store up food. Now that makes sense. So that when the 7 bad years come, you've got food stored.
Gotta be food that doesn't go bad.
Exactly. Remember, no refrigeration.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you can't, like, save the fish and the meat that long. But you can, I don't know, maybe they dried vegetables and dried, I mean, I don't know what they were able to do. And I guess grain you can store.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, I don't know, when you salt stuff and smoke stuff, I don't know. I mean, they used to keep those hams and stuff in those smoke houses for a long time. But whatever, you store the food for 7 years. And then when the bad 7 years come, you've got some food. Does that make sense? So this is like a revelation to Pharaoh. I mean, he gets really excited about this. I mean, he gets so excited, he can't even stand it. And Joseph isn't saying, let me do that. Don't worry, I'll organize it. Because, you know, when I worked for Potiphar, I organized everything. And when I was in the jail, so, you know, I've got, if you want to see my resume, you know, I'm a pretty good organizer. No, he says, have somebody do it. Have somebody manage it. So, again, this young guy is humble and doesn't speak up and say, hey, I'm your guy. I can do this. So that's nice. So let's read Pharaoh's reaction starting at 37.
This advice pleased Pharaoh and all his officials. Could we find another like him? Pharaoh asked his officials, a man so endowed with the Spirit of God.
Look what he says. He's endowed with the Spirit of God.
But Pharaoh didn't believe in our God.
Right. It's a polytheistic pagan culture. And Pharaoh says, this young man's in. He has the Spirit of God, capital S, capital G. Just like, you know, Nebuchadnezzar said, oh, you know, Daniel's God is the true God, so we have to worship him. And then the next chapter, he does something else stupid. But here, Pharaoh's like, well, the Spirit of God is in this guy. That's a pretty amazing thought for a pagan polytheistic guy. Because his astrologers and wise men would say, well, which God? You know, is it the God of the Nile? Is it the God of the war? Is it the sun god? I mean, which god are we talking about? Remember, pharaohs were claimed to be divine. They were descended from the sun god. So you had to worship the pharaoh. So for somebody who claims they're a god to say, oh, this young man has the Spirit of God in him, I mean, this is something that's inspired by the Holy Spirit. This isn't something Pharaoh just thinks about. Yeah, go ahead.
So Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, no one can be as wise and discerning as you are. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people shall dart at your command. Only in respect to the throne shall I outrank you. Herewith, Pharaoh told Joseph, I place you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. With that, Pharaoh took off his signet ring and put it on Joseph's finger. He had him dressed in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He then had him ride in the chariot of his visor, and they shouted, Abrek, before him. Thus was Joseph installed over the whole land of Egypt. I, Pharaoh, proclaim, he told Joseph, that without your approval, no one shall move hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also bestowed the name of Zaphnath-Paneth on Joseph, and he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of Helpolis. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of the Pharaoh, king of Egypt.
Okay, 30 years old. Keep that in mind as we go through the rest of it. So he's 30 years old when he comes into this power. Later on, we'll see the Levitical priests come into their full priesthood when they're 30. Before that, they're minor priests. Come into their full priesthood when they're 30. So the Pharaoh is so impressed by this, he makes Joseph the governor. He says, I'm the only one who's going to be higher than you because I'm on the throne. And to show you the power you're going to have, no one can move a hand or a foot in all of Egypt without your permission. You're going to have all the power other than you're going to be under me, but you're going to have all the power. I'm the only one higher. And he puts a signet ring on it, which is the sign of authority. The sign of authority. He gets the signet. And royal clothes. You know, kind of sounds like when the prodigal son comes back. He gets the ring, the clothes, on top of his smelly stuff. Well, Joseph's cleaned up by now. He took a shower, shaved. So don't send me back to that dungeon. No, you're going to be governor. So he gives them, he gives them an Egyptian name, and he gives them an Egyptian wife. And her, you know, she's, as you can see there, she's the daughter of a pagan priest. Which, you know, if you were the daughter of a priest, you were like, that was, you were pretty high in social standing. So Joseph becomes governor, gets power, gets the royal stuff on. Now, if you see pictures, I've never seen the movies about the Technicolor coat stuff, so I don't know if they have it, but Joseph's always depicted wearing the royal clothes of Egypt. Just like later Moses will be wearing it too if he grows up under Pharaoh's court. So he's got the ring of authority, because, you know, with the ring, he used to put in the hot wax, so you'd know that this came from whatever the rank was, the king or the governor or whatever. So when he sent a scroll someplace with orders, they'd seal it with wax, and he'd put the ring in it, and they'd go, oh, Joseph sent this. We better check this out. They probably would have called him by his Egyptian name. So presumably by this time, Joseph must be fluent in Egyptian. If he's been there, and he's been there a while now.
He kind of grew up there.
Really. He kind of grew up there, yeah. He was probably 16 when he got there. Now he's 30. So he's been there 14 years probably. We don't know what happens to Potiphar, Mrs. Potiphar, because we don't know if they get to see Joseph being the governor. But again, everything he does goes well. So he's the manager again, this time of the whole country. And what he does is he sets up storehouses all around the country. And during the 7 years of plenty, they're putting food into the storehouses. So he goes all around the land and he builds these storehouses and warehouses. So he's got a nice government job. He probably has a chauffeur, you know, personal chariot.
Pension.
Good government pension. Good health care plan. He's got no copay on any of his meds. No copay on any office visits.
He can vote himself a raise.
He can vote himself a raise.
Over years.
Yes. They said when you retire, you get 90% of your salary. So, a pretty good deal. So then the years of plenty actually happen. And there's huge harvests for 7 years. So they put what the Hebrew translation means, they put an immeasurable amount of grain into these storehouses. They couldn't even measure it, how much grain there was. Now remember, this is the first book of Moses. So Moses wrote about this 400 and some years later when he wrote this book. And the Hebrew language does not have numbers, does not have words for big numbers. That's why when you read through some of the Psalms and it says, you know, God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, we say, big deal, 1,000 hills. But to them, 1,000 was like this immeasurable number. Mm-hmm. Or they, when they call it, they say myriads of angels. It's like, there's so many of them, we can't count them. Mm-hmm. The Greeks said that the myriad was 25,000, but the Hebrews said, you can't even count how many there are. Well, we don't think 25,000 is that big of a deal. They thought it was a big deal. So they couldn't even measure how much grain there was. They couldn't count it. And so he stores all this grain in the storehouses. And then, of course, the famine's going to come. It says, Joseph stored up grain in great abundance like the sand of the sea until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. That's a lot of grain. A lot of grain. Now let's read 50 through 52.
Before the famine years set in, Joseph became the father of two sons, born to him by Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of Heliopolis. He named his firstborn Manasseh, meaning, God has made me forget entirely the sufferings I endured at the hands of my family. And the second he named Ephraim, meaning, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction.
Okay, stop there. Isn't that cool? So, two sons. Now, these guys, these boys are going to be very famous. At the end of Genesis, they're going to be very famous. When the people get back to the land, they're going to be very famous. And to this very day, I'll bet you right at this time, when there's little boys getting ready to go to bed, because they have to go to school tomorrow, they'll come up to their father, and their father will lay hands on their heads they'll say, may God make you like Manasseh and Ephraim. It's a traditional Hebrew blessing. To this day, and we're going to see it was initiated by Jacob when we get to chapter 49. They still, in every synagogue on Saturday morning, they call the kids forward, even the Messianic synagogues. Of course, in the Messianic synagogues, they add some New Testament figures to it, too. So the boys get blessed, the girls get blessed with, you know, the matriarchs, I guess you could call them, Sarah and Rivka and Leah and Rachel, and they add Esther, and then a Messianic place, they'll commonly add Miriam for Mary. And then, but the blessing of make you like Ephraim and Manasseh, Manasseh and Ephraim are still there. Now, Manasseh was born first, and you see that names mean so much. You know, God commonly changes people's names. You know, in Christian tradition, you take a name when you're baptized. You take a name when you're confirmed. You know, if you go into, the name means something. Look at the contrast. Manasseh means, I want to forget about all those creeps that were in my family. They threw me in the hole, then they sold me. You know, talk about dysfunctional family. The second boy, who's born just a little while later, means, hey, God made me fruitful while I was here. You know, I'm prospering. I got this great job. I'm governor of Egypt. Pharaoh loves me. My chauffeur picks me up every morning and takes me to the office. And, you know, I got a government computer. I got all the stuff. I just show him my government credit card whenever I have to buy something. So it's Ephraim. These two boys are going to be so important, not only for the blessing, but when Jacob gives them the final blessing before he dies, even though Joseph is the son of Jacob, you never hear about the tribe of Joseph. It ceases to be. You talk about the tribe of Manasseh and Ephraim. Joseph, like Moses, gets kind of a raw deal. He's the good one. So now he's got a family. He's ready for the famine. And then the famine comes. And the famine, as I said, is so extensive. Now there's some historical records that indicate the course of the river changed somehow, and the temperature changed, and so stuff didn't grow right. So there was famine. Just like, you know, one of the reasons that beer got so popular was, I don't know if you ever heard of the mini ice age, around 1300 the climate cooled, and places in Northern Europe, which used to be able to grow grapes, couldn't grow grapes anymore. And this is why you read these novels and literature about, you know, all the snow in London, and it never snows in London now, but when the earth cooled, there was snow all the time in London, the Dickens. Then in 1850, it started to warm again, but beer became important because they could grow the grain to make beer, but they couldn't grow the grapes to make wine in the northern, you know, northern Europe. The Italians and Greeks know that. Italians don't drink much beer.
Right.
Now let's go down to 55 and read 55 to the end of the chapter.
When hunger came to be felt throughout the land of Egypt and the people cried to Pharaoh for bread, Pharaoh directed all the Egyptians to go to Joseph and do whatever he told them. When the famine had spread throughout the land, Joseph opened all the cities that had grain and rationed it to the Egyptians, since the famine had gripped the land of Egypt. In fact, all the world came to Joseph to obtain rations of grain, for famine had gripped the whole world.
So the Egyptians got the stuff, and they even sold food to people who came. They were involved in the famine. So Joseph's plan worked really well. Now we're not going to read all of this because it's a lot. And a lot of it is confusing about what he does with his brothers. Because now he's going to deal with his brothers again. And they're not going to know who he is. But he's going to know who they are. Now, typically, what I would do is say, tough, bub. Well. You sold me into slavery. You're not getting a kernel of this grain. So go see if you can buy grain somewhere else. Because this is the thing where we're going to get to how he becomes a type of the Messiah, because he's going to say, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. And I forgive you for what you did. You mistreated me. You brutalized me in a way. You sold me off. My brothers sold me, which is a type of what happens to the Messiah, Jesus. You know, his brethren sold him. His brethren rejected him. His brethren killed him. I mean, they don't kill Joseph, but you see a lot of parallels.
Tried to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you see a lot of parallels. And, you know, it's kind of like all, well, it's like all the parallels you see with Abraham and Isaac. We talked about this, right? I mean, you know, one of the things on Yom Kippur, with the reason you blow shofars, is because the ram was caught in the thicket, in the thorns, and the sheep dies instead of the boy. So the sheep dies in his place after he's carried the wood up, and the sacrifice, you know, the altars made ready, and you know, which is the cross, of course. And God spares the human son, but doesn't spare his own son. And the ram's even caught in thorns, you know, like the crown of thorns. And then it's sacrificed. And the ancient rabbis wrote that to God, the sacrifice of Isaac is always before him, even though Isaac didn't really die. And that he becomes a type of Messiah. Because the sacrifice of Jesus is always before God. And that's how we're forgiven of our sin. Right? Or else God could say, why should I get you into heaven? Look at you. You know, look at all the things. I got a list here, everything you did. But you've been forgiven because you've repented. And you wouldn't be able to repent if it wasn't for the blood. So the ancient rabbis wrote that the ashes of the ram, of the sheep, God sees as the ashes of Isaac, because the ram died in his place. The sacrifice of Jesus, he sees that instead of our death. So we're going to see this is going to develop with Joseph too. So just start reading in 42. We're not going to read all of this.
When Jacob learned that grain rations were available in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you keep gaping at one another?" "I hear," he went on, "that rations of grain are available in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us that we may stay alive rather than die of hunger." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy an emergency supply of grain from Egypt. It was only Joseph's full brother Benjamin that Jacob did not send with the rest, for he thought some disaster might befall him. Thus, since there was famine in the land of Canaan also, the sons of Israel were among those who came to procure rations.
Yeah. So, Jacob says, instead of you guys like sitting around here watching TV all day, why don't you go to Egypt, because they got grain.
Get off your
butt and do something, instead of sitting around here whining and looking at each other. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to take Benjamin, because if something happens and you guys are all killed, I want to at least have one of my sons left here, even though there's nothing to eat. So Benjamin gets left behind. The other 10 go. Now remember, Joseph is the governor. He's responsible for how the food's going to be distributed. So the 10 brothers are going to come, and he's going to be in charge of giving out the stuff. How cool is that? Now, it does get a little confusing, but let's read, go ahead from 6.
It was Joseph, as governor of the country, who dispensed the rations to all the people. When Joseph's brothers came and knelt down before him with their faces to the ground, he recognized them as soon as he saw them. But he concealed his own identity from them and spoke sternly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked them. They answered, "From the land of Canaan to procure food." When Joseph recognized his brothers, although they did not recognize him, he was reminded of the dreams he had had about them.
Okay, pause there. So now Joseph, they don't know that it's him. They don't know that it's his brother. You know, the people didn't recognize that Jesus was Messiah, even though he was their brother in the flesh. They didn't recognize him as their brother. And Joseph's wearing all the royal stuff. He's got all the cool stuff and the ring. He's probably got cool shoes. And he's certainly not hungry like they are because he's got plenty of food. He probably gets to go to like royal banquets and stuff. So he doesn't know, that the brothers don't know, but he recognizes them. Now, he hasn't seen them in probably by this time. I mean, it might be 20 years. I mean, the 14 years of plenty and famine have come. Plus, there was probably 14 years before that. He hasn't seen these dudes in, you know, 28 years.
Wow.
But he recognizes them. Plus, I mean, these were a pretty ragtag bunch. You know what I mean? You don't... When you're used to living with royalty and this ragtag 10 guys show up that are not only look like a mess, but they're hungry, and you probably say, "Oh, I think I know who these guys are." He knew they came from Canaan. A sorry bunch, I tell them. Like when Jesus walked with his apostles, the leaders probably said, "What a sorry bunch, what a sorry looking bunch." Look, they're not wearing all the cool stuff. Their accent gives them away. They wear their beard different than we do. Oh, look at them. They're from a place where no prophets have come from. There's no schools there. No kind of religious teaching has ever come from there. There's only 7 synagogues in all of Galilee. And look at all the stuff we have here. So... You know, who do these guys think they are coming in here and talking to us? Remember in Acts when they bring Peter and John in, and the guy says, "You guys aren't even educated. Why are you talking about all this stuff? You guys aren't even educated." He's governor. They don't know him, but he knows them. And they come and bow down before him so he remembers his dreams. So now the sheeps are bowing down to him. Like in the dream, they bowed down to his sheath, which made them mad. Now they're in the compromised position, not him. It reminds me of not that this is related necessarily, but it reminds me of an Easter time sermon I heard somebody give where he said, imagine Caiaphas when he dies. And he comes face to face with Jesus and goes, you mean you really are who you said you were? I really did say take him and crucify him? Oh, I think I'm in big trouble now." I wonder, you know, I wonder sometimes, Pontius Pilate committed suicide.
Did he?
Yeah. Yeah, about 10 years later. But, you know, Pilate had more respect for Jesus than those religious leaders did. So, I mean, I wonder, in that time before he died, you know, after Good Friday and, you know, that whole Easter weekend, he probably thought about Jesus a lot. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't something that he just said, "Oh, I don't remember that." I mean, I'm not saying he was saved, but, you know, I don't...
Could be.
It could be. He talks to them kind of harshly because he's trying to cover himself. He doesn't want to tell them who he is. He doesn't want to be really nice to them. So he kind of covers it with terseness. I don't want to read all that, but it's all very, very terse. And he accuses them of being spies. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know. You know, I've thought about this many times as to what the point of that was. Was it just human Joseph saying, well, I'll fix them. I'm going to make them squirm a little bit. Or was he just trying to cover up his identity? I don't know. But he accuses them of being spies and says, basically, you know, how do I know you're not just here to scout out the land and you're going to attack and you're going to take our stuff? And he actually puts him in prison for 3 days. And he wants to see Benjamin. He wants to see Benjamin. Okay, read, we're in chapter 42. Read starting at 18.
On the third day, Joseph said to them, if you do this, you shall live. I am a God-fearing man. If you are honest, let one of your brothers remain confined in your prison while the rest go and carry food for the needs of your families. You shall bring me your youngest brother. Thus your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they agreed. They said to one another, alas, we are guilty regarding our brother, whose anguish of heart we witnessed. When he pleaded with us, we did not heed. Therefore his anguish has come upon us. Reuben remarked, did I not say to you, do not sin against the boy? But you would not listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood.
Okay. So now all of a sudden their consciences convict them. We're being punished because of what we did to our brother. They think he's dead or who knows where. They don't know this is Joseph who's talking to them.
So here they don't know it's him?
No, they don't know it's him yet. So their consciences are convicted that we committed this horrible sin against our brother, and that's why we're in trouble. This is going to go bad, and it's our own fault. And then Reuben pipes up and says, I told you not to hurt him. They even say, look, remember how he pleaded with us. Now, even though it was maybe 28 years before, you would still remember your brother pleading with you to not harm him. And we just ignored him. We just sold him off as a slave. And so now we have to pay for that blood. And there's this idea, you know, without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness of sin. So now blood starts to come in. And from here on, everything's going to be about blood once they get across the Red Sea and into the wilderness. But if we're going to have to pay for this with our blood. You know, it's, you know, life, you know, God tells the people, life is in the blood. Sin can only be atoned for by the shedding of blood. And why is that? It's a symbol of something. Because when you sin, you die. Spiritual death, certainly. But even physical death, you know, St. Paul says in Romans, all men sin, therefore all men die. When Adam and Eve sinned, he said, well, you're going to die for taking a bite of a fruit. And yet we think God's going to overlook any manner of horrible things. Oh, he's not going to care anymore about that. Maybe he used to care about it, but I think I'm okay. He didn't forgive them for taking a bite of an apple or whatever it was. But without the shedding of blood, there's not forgiveness of sin. Because life, you forfeit your life when you sin. Now, for those of us who follow Jesus, we're in a different place than, you know, the people out there who say, oh, that's just a bunch of crap. Right? I mean, the people out there who say, oh, that Jesus stuff is a bunch of crap, and they just go on with their, you know, day-to-day sinful life, they're in a much different position than we are, because when we sin, we realize that we've sinned. I mean, we realize now that we've done something that's interrupted the relationship and we repent of it. But when you never repent of anything, I mean, where does that leave you? So life is forfeited and life is in the blood. So blood has to be shed. And this, of course, is the cross. You know, if Jesus would have lived to be 80, and had a stroke and died, we'd still be in our sin. If he'd have got pneumonia when he was 40 and died, we'd still be in our sin. But blood had to be shed. now we start to see, like, oh, blood is going to be required of us. We have to pay for his blood. And they also, since they don't know this is Joseph, and they think this is some Egyptian, you know, governor, they don't even realize he can understand them. So they're talking, they don't realize he can understand them. That Joseph understands everything that they're saying. Oh, you know, we shouldn't have done this. Oh, I told you guys not to do this. Oh, now we're in big trouble. Now we got to pay for blood. And he understands the whole thing. And even he spoke to them through an interpreter just to keep the thing going. So even though he understands them, he has an interpreter. So they leave Simeon behind. Joseph says, you have to leave one of you guys behind. So you could go back to the land, you can take food, but then you have to come back with Benjamin. And we've got Simeon here, Shimon, as the hostage to make sure you come back.
How did he know Benjamin was?
I don't know.
They don't say.
Then so he knows there's a little brother. He wants to see the little brother. Later, the little, of course, Benjamin's no little kid anymore by the time this happens. He's by his late 20s. But he's going to give 5 times more stuff to Benjamin than he's going to give to the other brothers. Because it's like, you know, his little brother that he hasn't. Plus those other guys were creeps. Benjamin wasn't. Yeah, so look and see in verse 23. They did not know Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. And look what happens. Then he turned away from them and wept. So Joseph's like just like overwhelmed by all this. Remember how he pleaded with us? So Joseph has to excuse himself and he has to go cry and get it out of his system. Then he comes up with this plan. You leave Simeon. You go back to your father. You can take food. When you come back with Benjamin, then I'll release Simeon too, and then you can go back with more food. It's kind of like the original plan. And you notice that Joseph says, I fear God, capital G. He doesn't say, I fear the gods of Egypt. Now these boys that are there, there's 10 of them there, Jacob and little Benjamin are at home, they know the true God. They know the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, Jacob's still there. Mm-hmm. So they know the true God. And so the boys know God, know that there's one God. And their children, you know, we're starting to develop the nation now. They know that there's one God. So when Joseph says, you know, I fear God, capital G, he doesn't say, oh, you know, I don't want to get in trouble with the gods of Egypt. Because, you know, the Pharaoh's descended from the sun god. And I don't want the wind god to get mad at me, and I don't want the Nile god to get mad at me. And I'm even a little worried about the moon god. But no, he says, I fear God, capital G. Now, this should have come as a shock to these other guys. Why is this Egyptian talking about he fears God, capital G, when you guys worship, you know, 200 gods? So that's kind of interesting. Not the gods of Egypt. So he gives them grain, he puts the money that they will pay him back in their sacks. And what does that mean? What is this? Why do they need this grain?
To survive.
Yeah, they're going to die if they don't have it. They're willing to pay for the grain. He gives it to them free. He becomes a prefigurement of Jesus the Messiah. Because you get life for free. You get salvation. It's a free gift. You can't pay for it. You can't earn it. You can't go someplace and say to God, you know what? If you save me today, if you save me when I die, I promise I'm going to give $10,000 to that church over there, and I'm going to give $10,000 to, you know, the charity over there, and I'm going to help that, you know, poor old priest over there who's retired. I'm going to give him my, I'm going to give all these people all my money if you just promise I'm going to go to heaven. Because, you know, I like to use the example of when you make a contract with somebody, right? We've done this before, but Lisa probably doesn't know, and you guys probably weren't around, but, you know, if you hire somebody to build a deck, and you go buy the material, you put all the material in the backyard, the guy says, I'll build your deck for $30 an hour. And you say, okay. So in 8 hours, he's got the deck done. So you say, okay, $30 an hour times 8 hours, here's your $240. Because that's what you agreed to. Right? That's a contract. So God says, here's the contract. I give you 613 laws. You keep them all perfectly, and you're going to be saved. How's that sound? Doesn't sound very doable. So salvation is not a contract. It's not something that you say, I think I've done enough now to earn it. I worked the 8 hours. You said if I worked 8 hours building the deck, I was going to be saved. Or I gave $10,000 to that church over there. That was the deal, right? You were going to save me if I did that. So here, the grain, which represents life, is given to them for free. It's their life, and it's stands for a type of salvation. Free gift. So how cool is that? So on the way home, they find the money. It's back in the sacks. So they go, wow, that Egyptian guy, that was pretty cool. He put all the money back in our sacks. Maybe he's going to charge our credit card. I don't know. But he put the money back in the sack. So they emptied the sacks, and behold, every man's bundle of money was in the sack. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were dismayed. And Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me of one of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And now you want to take Benjamin with you. So in other words, I lost Joseph years ago. Now you left Simeon over there, so he's as good as dead. And now you want to take Benjamin back. So Jacob, he's not getting this, you know, divine plan thing. Of course, nobody would if you were living it in real time. You know, it's easy for us to see things looking back. You know, hindsight's always 20/20. But when you're living it in real time, you know, I always like to use the example of, you know, Joseph and Mary. Not this Joseph. Say Joseph and Mary. They're betrothed. Mary says, well, I have to tell you something. I'm pregnant, and this angel came. And, you know, we say, oh, yes.
Yeah, right.
But if you're Joseph, you say, what? How could you do this to me? It doesn't say that he said that, but it says he wanted to protect her from the law. Now, how would any man react if you were engaged to somebody and she came and said, oh, I have to tell you, I'm pregnant. And you know one thing, it's not your baby. What are you going to assume? Oh, this angel came and, oh, yeah. Right. That's believable. Well, of course, later he believes it. But when you're living it, it's very difficult. Or even when Gabriel tells Mary all these things, and, you know, you're carrying the Holy One and all these things, when you actually have a baby, and you're feeding the baby and changing the baby, and the baby falls asleep, and you're sitting there looking in the crib going, who is this kid? Who is this boy? What? You know, Joseph standing there going, it's not my son. You know, when you see I like to think of things in real time. And, it isn't like people walking around like this with halos. It's like real human experiences. Or when little Jesus said something, you know, really profound or something that was, you know, a five-year-old wouldn't know, did they go like, how does he know that? Oh, yeah, I remember Gabriel told me. Like, you know, sometimes your five-year-old says something that you say, how do you know that? So they deserve punishment, but they get blessing. This is the good news of the gospel. We deserve punishment, but we get blessing. See, if you showed up, well, to use a silly thing that, of course, we know it doesn't work this way, but you show up at the pearly gates and you say, I'm here. And God looks at you and says, wait a minute. You've kept every single law imperfectly since the time you were born until 5 minutes ago when you died. Wait a minute. I gotta recheck this. Well, then God is obliged to save you. Because the deal was, you keep all this law and you'll be saved. And if that was still the criteria, heaven would be a pretty bleak, not bleak place, but it wouldn't be anybody there.
Still pretty empty.
But you deserve punishment, but you get life. You deserve punishment, but you get blessing. You deserve punishment. In this case, you get grain. And so these are some more of the types of Joseph. He blesses his brothers. You know, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing.